this meeting has been fun and different. And before Kevin, like, torments me any further, he was good enough to have some of these thoughts in solitude cards printed up. And so he asked me to pass them out to people at the meeting. And they were really, it's very lovely. It's a Thomas Merton passage. And I used it. It became part of my third step conversation. But I guess let's begin. I've got to qualify. My name is Leslie. My last name is Gray. I am an alcoholic. Now, the nature of this meeting is that the speakers need to have 30 years of continuous sobriety or more, so I need to qualify myself for that. And in order to qualify myself for that, I'll tell you, I had my last drink February 23rd, 1981. So that's more than 30 years ago. I was young then. It was a long time ago. But I want to just kind of pick up where we left off. You know, the steps flow in a sequence. And, you know, when you may recall, as we were talking about step three in the big book, our basic text is the big book. And if not, you haven't noticed by now, people who've been here, my pattern is kind of set. And I got sober using the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and the 12 and 12, and my very favorite book, as Bill sees it. Mine is all beat up. It's well used, and I've got stuff stuck in it, and, you know, other thoughts that kind of would fit. And I've wore this book out. I know they have one here. But when we went to the third step, which is part of the chapter How It Works, and that was the beginning, that first reading that was read was How It Works. And it talked about taking the third step, and in the big book, it talks about next. And that means next. I want to talk a little, before I get too deeply into next though, well, let me just finish this thought. It says, next, we launched into a vigorous course of action, the first step of which is a personal housekeeping, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect. That means the third step, that decision was crucial and vital, but it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. And therefore, we start upon a personal inventory that was step four. Now, I want to circle back just a tiny bit because I wanted to talk about for me, my experience was, you know, a lot of people talk about how hard the first year is, and, you know, it's an adjustment. There's no doubt about that. But to me, I wanted to mention the pitfalls and the struggles of year number two. Okay, I thought for me, year number two was very difficult because the first year everything was kind of like different and good. And I wasn't drunk all the time, and I wasn't getting into overt problems, and I was like starting to conform and, you know, be a worker and all of that good stuff. You know, and it was spring and I was sober, and it was summer and I was sober, and it was autumn and I was sober, and it was winter and I was sober, and I got sober in February, so there we go. So now we're in February, and I wake up, you know, February, March, and, you know, there's still a lot of stuff wrong with me, and I'm not drunk. And it was very, number two was kind of when the work really began in earnest and the reality of it set in. When I was getting sober, people told me it took about 5 years to really clear out my head, get the spaghetti out of your head, is the expression that was used, and I didn't believe it until I had 5 years, then I believed it. So I don't want to, you know, be a negative Nancy, but I started with 0 days like everybody else, and day by day, I just want to make that point, because see, what I had to do when I found out that everything that was wrong with me wasn't strictly my drinking, I needed to do something about it. And I needed to do more than just not pick up the next drink. And that's where the rest of the steps came in. And that's where this inventory came in. I'm going to start my favorite book again, As Bill Sees It, which is all taped up. And if you're new, I would highly suggest you get this, because I liked it because there was an index and whatever crap was floating in my head, I could look it up. But anyway, I want to start at page 10 in As Bill Sees It. And this is from a letter that Bill Wilson wrote in 1946. And what he said was, "A clear light seems to fall upon us when we open our eyes. Since our blindness is caused by our own defects, we must first deeply realize what they are. Constructive meditation is the first requirement for each new step in our spiritual growth." And so it begins. There was one other phrase and a little section, and this was a big go-to for me. Over 38 years, I've gone to this again and again, and before we really dive into the fourth step. This is an item from The Grapevine, which is our meeting in print from July 1965. And this is page 115, The Essence of Growth. "Let us never fear needed change. Certainly we have to discriminate between changes for worse and changes for better. But once a need becomes clearly apparent in an individual, in a group, or in AA as a whole, it has long since been found that we cannot stand still and look the other way. The essence of all growth is a willingness to change for the better, and then an unremitting willingness to shoulder whatever responsibility this entails." And I'd read that over and over again anytime I needed to do something different. And, you know, the second year of my recovery, certainly I needed to start doing something different and working on these steps. And my time sequence is a little bit off, but after I did three, I did four. That was what my sponsor believed in. That was what she told me to do. And so, therefore, that is what I did. And it was around not a year-ish, but a little closer, a little less than a year-ish that I was doing this. But getting started in our book, The 12 and 12, it talks about, you know, a lot of our defects are rooted in our instincts. And it's normal, it's natural for us to have instincts, and it is for me. But it talks about they often exceed what's our proper function. This book, The 12 and 12, mentions that nearly every serious emotional problem can be seen as a case of misdirected instinct. When that happens, our natural assets, the instincts, have turned into mental and physical liabilities. And the point of step four, this book goes on to say, is that we want to find out exactly how, when, and where our natural desires have warped us. We wish to look squarely at the unhappiness this has caused for ourselves and others. By discovering what our emotional deformities are, we can move toward their correction. Without a willing and persistent effort to do this, there can be little sobriety or contentment for us. Without a searching and fearless moral inventory, most of us have found that the faith which really works in daily living is still out of reach. Which meant to me, you know, when I was having that discomfort, you know, that restless, irritable discontent, that not right, like I'm not drinking, but I'm not right. There's a lot of stuff wrong. I needed to look at my defects, and that's what the step allowed me to do. The books go on to talk about when a human being becomes a battleground for instincts, there can be no peace. And I've experienced that type of agitation. I'm guessing most of you have, but I'm here to talk about my experience mainly and to connect it to what helped me get sober, which is these books and this program. But that agitation, that upset in my gut, there's nothing right with me. Alcoholics should be able to see that instincts run wild in themselves as the underlying cause of their destructive drinking. And that was true for me. I mean, I was hiding out, or I would use my defects as an excuse to drink. The book talks about this perverse soul sickness is not pleasant to look upon. Instincts on rampage balk at investigation. So it's self-preserving, you know, like my disease is out there alive and well. You know, it is there, it'll come back to me anytime I let up and let go of my higher power and the good things that I've learned in this program. But the book goes on to talk about, you know, ways we avoid it. If we're depressive, if we're ego-driven, you know, some people talk about they get swamped with guilt and self-loathing. I did that. To be a woman alcoholic is, in my opinion, in my experience, there's a lot of guilt and there's a lot of shame involved in that. You know, women are supposed to be kind of nice, and I kind of wasn't. And I did things that I wouldn't want put in the daily newspaper. So there it was, you know, things that I you know, it's a lot of water under, and even sober. So that guilt, that shame, the program on going forward is always there to help me work through that stuff. But we can wallow in this messy bog, often getting a misshapen and painful pleasure out of it. I love the way they wrote this stuff, you know, that wallowing in that depression and that self-loathing, and it's so easy and it's so warm and comfortable and it's so useless and so not helping to me getting on with my life and living in a way that I can be happy and free and able to look at myself in the mirror and be okay with myself. So as we morbidly pursue this melancholy activity, we may sink to such a point of despair that nothing but oblivion looks possible. We've lost all perspective and therefore all genuine humility. For this is pride in reverse. So that ugly wallowing, which I indulged in, was kind of, you know, attention seeking, kind of reverse, kind of pride in a funny way. So, you know, that's how it was for me. Anyway, there are those then who think that our anxieties are caused by other people. And the book goes on to talk about self-justification and resentment. This is the 12 and 12. The book talks about we thought conditions drove us to drink. Self-justification was the maker of excuses, of course, for drinking and for all kinds of crazy and damaging conduct. And I can tell you, I mean, I involved myself in crazy and damaging conduct sober. When I was newly sober and even beyond, but not so much anymore. It's sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But the book talks about we thought conditions drove us to drink. I thought conditions drove me to drink. I didn't get that it was my disease that drove me to drink and that I justified my disease through my defects, and I want this, and I'm unhappy, and all the da-da-da-da. But we slowly learned, what it talks about in the book is, we slowly learned that something had to be done about our vengeful resentments, self-pity, and unwarranted pride. We had to see that every time we played the big shot, we turned people against us. We had to see that when we harbored grudges and planned revenge for such defeats, we were really beating ourselves with the club of anger we had intended to use on others. We learned that if we were seriously disturbed, our first need was to quiet that disturbance, regardless of who or what we thought caused it. We had to admit that we had many of these defects, even though such disclosures were painful and humiliating. So this all kind of comes down to, you know, what's the point of doing all this? Like, why do we want to look into, you know, the litany of what's wrong with Leslie? You know, I mean, why? What does that help? This is why. Because I'm unhappy until I get a handle on where my thoughts are, where my emotions were. Why am I always clashing with people? And I did clash with people. I'm not shy to talk, and I'm not shy to debate with people, and that's not necessarily a good thing if you take a couple of drinks, you know? So, anyway, pride lures us into making demands on ourselves and upon others, which cannot be met without perverting or misusing our God-given instincts. And again, I mean, I said it before, I thought I was very special, I was very smart, I was college educated, I was young when many people weren't so young here. But anyway, but I was failing. And for me, that generates fear. And lo and behold, they talk about fear in these books. A soul sickness in its own right. Then the fear, in turn, generates more character defects. And so I would do things because I was afraid, and I would act with bravado or hide or, you know, but it was fear, a lot of fear. I became envious. And this struck me too, you know, because I couldn't understand. I was a drunk and I lost a nice job and on and, you know, it took a little effort to get things back. But, you know, this struck me when I read it. You know, I thought because I didn't drink anymore, everything should come to me. And they had something for me in this where it says, with genuine alarm at the prospect of work, we stay lazy. And, yeah, that could be me too. And then it talks about the willingness, but what the reason that we do this is not to beat ourselves up. It's not to it's to figure out who we were. I needed to understand how I ticked and how I was driven and led around by these defects of character. But, you know, there's always a carrot and a stick, and the stick is, unless he is now willing to work hard at the elimination of the worst of these defects, both sobriety and peace of mind will still elude him. All the faulty foundation of his life will have to be torn out and built anew on bedrock. And I can tell you that everything, all the demographic facts about me when I came into the rooms are now different. So everything has changed, everything. And I don't mean just the passage of years, the way I think, the way I do things, the way I relate to people, but that's a part of this process. I wanted to mention this part because this really was my key defect, and it's kind of long, but I'm going to just tell it to you anyway, okay? The primary fact that we failed to because I was very special. You've heard me say that, right? I was very smart and very special and very young. The primary fact that we fail to recognize is our total inability to form a true partnership with another human being. Our egomania digs two disastrous pitfalls. Either we insist on dominating the people we know, or we depend upon them far too much. If we lean too heavily on people, they will sooner or later fail us, for they are human too and cannot possibly meet our incessant demands. In this way, our insecurity grows and festers. When we habitually try to manipulate others to our willful desires, they revolt and resist us heavily. Then we develop hurt feelings, a sense of persecution, and a desire to retaliate. As we redouble our efforts in control and continue to fail, our suffering becomes acute and constant. Now here's the part that just like, you know, as I say, like I would read this stuff and I'd cry my heart out because it was just like getting hit in the face again and again. But here's the part. We have not once sought to be one in a family, to be a friend among friends, to be a worker among workers, to be a useful member of society. Always we tried to struggle to the top of the heap or to hide underneath it. This self-centered behavior blocked a partnership relation with any one of those about us. Of true brotherhood, we had small comprehension. See, that was me. It took years. You know, I took the step. I wrote about this and my resentments and on and on. I'm going to talk about doing the actual step because this kind of relates, this all part relates to the usefulness. Why do we do this anyway? I mean, who wants to dig into all this jazz? But whatever the defects, they finally ambushed us, meaning me, into alcoholism and misery. And I just could not relate to people in a regular way. You know, I really couldn't be. It was a revelation to finally start to be one of the group, you know, part of the team. You know, it's so simple, yet it was so out of reach for me. But that's what the 12 and 12 has to say. They also say it is wise to write our questions and answers. It will be an aid to clear thinking and honest appraisal. And it will be the first tangible evidence of our complete willingness to move forward. You know, so much of the program is about willingness. I mean, no one here can make any of us do anything. We're volunteers here. The jail, the court may send us to a meeting, but they can't make us do the work. And our sponsor can make suggestions, and, you know, our loved ones can be available. But sooner, you know, we have to supply our own motivation. We have to supply our own willingness, and we have to buy in. Just like it says in How It Works, you know. We don't fail when we follow the path. We have to be able to be honest. And, you know, the alcoholic is immature, and that book talks a lot about erratic emotions and self-pity and terminal uniqueness. I keep saying that, but it's so me that I have to. And I want to go back to one more thing about self-pity, because I really felt sorry for myself, okay? Because when I came into the rooms, you know, those of you who are here and know or who have heard me lead, I mean, I was, when I came into the rooms, there was not a lot of people under the age of 30. There was not a lot of women. It felt like everybody had fought World War II and would talk about all this stuff I didn't know about. And some of them actually told me, are you sure you belong here? You kind of look like a cheerleader. And I think, you know, what are you trying to get rid of me? You know, how dare you throw me? You know, it was like always backwards with me. You know, some people don't want to be here, and I seemed to me I don't know, unless they were slicking me. But anyway, to my self-pity, again, as Bill sees it, Bill Wilson in a letter, 1966, self-pity is one of the most unhappy and consuming defects that we know. It is a bar to all spiritual progress and can cut off all effective communication with our fellows because of its inordinate demands for attention and sympathy. It is a maudlin form of martyrdom which we can ill afford. And who doesn't love to be the martyr? I mean, I certainly love to be the martyr. The remedy? Well, let's have a hard look at ourselves, and still a harder one at AA's 12 Steps to Recovery. When we see how many of our fellow AAs have used the steps to transcend great pain and adversity, we shall be inspired to try these life-giving principles for ourselves. And self-pity for me has always been a trap, you know, and I remember being a kid and my sister telling me, let's have a pity party, 1, 2, 3, aww. And apparently I was born to it, so, you know, or I was ready, you know, AA was out there for me, who knew. But it's most important, the big book is AA's Basic Text and Book of Experience, and that's why I keep going back to it. That's, you know, that's what there was then. For the most part, it was big book, 12 and 12, step meetings, beginners meetings. I got sober in Pittsburgh, that's what they did. But, you know, in the big book, it talks about next. and that meant next, and to get on with it. The 12 and 12 talks about writing a step being the first tangible evidence of actually buying into and being a part of and doing the work of the program and working to working the program. The big book points out resentment is the number one offender, and it sets out a grid system. I took It's in the book, you know, and if you look at the big book, it has that with the three columns, and it talks about the resentments and the fears. But our big book presents a system. Some of the rehabs and some of the other books have some charts and whatnot. They're kind of modifications of this. But, you know, the book talks about this is a fact-finding mission. It takes courage to do this. It takes faith to do this, and it takes courage. And, you know, in my work life, I've talked to people, especially at my last job, you know, they would present themselves as the biggest badasses ever. And people who did not, and I'd say, you know, do you know who's tougher than you? People who have the balls to look at themselves in the mirror and be honest. And so far, you may not have done that. And it takes a lot of guts, so don't underestimate it. It does, but, you know, with the help of God and a program and a solid sponsor and the people around us, it's worth it. Nothing that's worth it is easy. And the book tells us that people of faith have courage. And I believe that, you know, people. My faith has given me courage to do things and to face things that I didn't want to do. I do want to talk about, the big book talks about resentment, and this is important. I want to say this because we keep hearing again and again, sorry, I'm going to say it again and again, that relapse is a part of recovery. And to that, again, I'm going to say BS. It is not a part of recovery. It is a part of the disease, but it's not a part of recovery. And I want to say what the big book says about this. The big book talks about it as plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness, which means I had to fight, drop the aggravation and blaming everybody and holding on to all this stuff because I was killing myself. They say that resentment's like drinking poison and waiting for the other guy to die. And that's true. I found that to be true. But anyway, to the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? That with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when we harbor such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. And that's true. That's true. I heard resentment explained once, too, by a man who was an old-timer when I was very new. And he has now gone on to that big meeting in the sky. But he's a lovely man. And he explained resentment like this. He said, if I'm walking down the street and someone walks up and smacks me in the face, and I'm upset and I cry, then that's anger. That's explainable. He said, but if 20 years later I still have tears in my eyes and I'm holding on to it, that's resentment, and that's on me. So that's the difference of just holding on to that stuff. And when it occurred to me, thank God for the program, then that's it. So anyway, we look for our own mistakes, where we've been selfish. Where had we been selfish? Dishonest, self-seeking. It talks about fear, and I can be very distorted by fear as well, you know, and made me do crazy things. I would set myself up to be hurt because of fear. The book talks about that. I mean, that's happened in my own life. You know, I would associate with people because I was afraid. I didn't see how I could get something accomplished. I mean, I can actually point to a marriage I had that was kind of like that. That was my first one. And that was, if I'm real honest, part of that was I needed to accomplish something, and I couldn't see how I could do it alone. And I was young, and I found some guy who could help me. And that was, you know, there's something about that. I don't know if I want to say this on record, but, you know, if you're a girl in your late 20s, that you can be like catnip to a certain category of male people, and there it is. And, you know, and if you have a defective character, you can sometimes use that fact to your benefit, and sometimes it blows up in your face because it is a defect. Thankfully, we don't have to drink over all of our defects once we're in the rooms, but we do have to be honest about them, or we will. But it goes on to talk about sex, you know. The big book also talks about, you know, people. There's a period of time. God, I'm running out of time. There's a period of time when I was in Pittsburgh where I got sober, and then even here, it was like people who wanted me to sponsor them because they needed to do a fourth step. I don't know how I got to be in that position, but I was. I do believe my sponsor told me that the fourth step is what starts to separate the women from the girls, and that people who do the fourth step and go forward stay sober. People who put it off tend to not. They tend to not stay sober, and I was afraid to get drunk again. It's as simple as that. So whatever I needed to do, I would do, and I would find the courage to do it and lean on God. But the thing about doing a fourth step is how it works. At the end of that chapter continues, and it's such a nice ending. It says, "We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you have already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. You have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself." See, that told me, that was explained to me by my sponsor, that meant that fourth step didn't need to be perfect. It needed to get the big stuff that was really in my way that was going to send me to a drink, and to just get it out and to get started. So to not let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and to just go forward and do it. You know, God's with us. Our sponsors are with us. But, you know, that's how we go forward. But that seemed to have been my part. I've helped people do fourth steps. I've done it here, and I guess that's it. I'm way over time, but thank you for listening. That's it. Thank you.
All right. Now, do we have any questions from the class?
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you. I've explained it all perfectly.
Yeah.
Oh, you have a question?
So you mentioned the grid that's in the big book. Is that the format that you use when you take someone through the fourth step?
If they're willing to go along with it, yeah, that's the one I use, and that's the one I start with. But, you know, sometimes they want to do it off of a form that they're comfortable with. And most of the ones that I've worked with, they all kind of track this anyway, so it's most important that, you know, because the grid in the big book talks about who we resent, what happened, and how we think it affected us. And so if whatever they use tracks that, then c'est la vie. But, you know, when this came out, there wasn't anything. There wasn't no Glen Bay or Hazleton or any of that stuff. There was this. So that's kind of it. So I guess not always.
I have a question. Usually a lot of people talk about how they felt afterwards, you know, after the fourth step. Would you want to touch on that a little bit?
Well, after I did the fourth step and before I did the fifth step, I was kind of agitated because it was all there and it hadn't been gotten rid of yet. But it did, you know, I felt good about myself because I started to take the bull by the horns and I didn't have to live like this anymore, you know, and I didn't want to drink. So I felt like I was making some progress, doing something that took some courage to do, and finding the willingness and the courage to do that.
I feel you on that one. I saw in the paper all my, you know, how fearful I was in every aspect of my life. I could see it, and that I think that changed a lot for me. All right. Anybody else?
Oh, of course.
Thanks, Kevin.
We can't get away without a Kevin question. So.
Exactly. Anyway, thanks again for coming out on Halloween.
Sorry I didn't dress up except for my spider
pants. Oh, you got
nice
pants,
you know?
So that's even better. Anyway, you said that you've been fortunate enough to take a number of people through a four-step. My question is, in the book says, I think it says next, you know, you do this four-step. How do you handle the person that's in the process of doing that four-step? In other words, do you have like a timeline? Do you say, okay, when you're done, call me? You know, and they call you 3 years later and say, yep, I think I'm done?
No. We would, you know, people who I would work, when I worked my fourth step, in a way I work a fourth step with people who are willing to work with me, is that we meet periodically. We'll meet like every other week and go through
what
they've done and if they want to talk about it. I mean, for myself and for others, sometimes, I mean, this stuff, it's like a boggled mess because this is the stuff we drank on and wrecked our life over, and airing it out and help me clarify my thoughts. And what I'm told is, you know, those ladies, us talking, help them clarify their thoughts and get things down on paper in a way that made sense, that helped them get to where they needed to be. And I do want to say I sponsored this one girl, and she kept saying she would write things down and tear it up. And it's like, I said, don't tear it. She said, I'm never going to get done. I said, quit tearing it up. And she's like, oh, like that was a big revelation. Just stick it in the drawer. Don't tear it up. This was back in the day when we wrote on tablets and stuff, you know, but she'd tear it up and then call me and say, I tore it up. I said, don't tear it up.
Okay,
but so periodic conversation, like every other week, you know, just to keep it moving but not push too much. And just go out and have coffee and talk about it. Bring your jottings. And
I think you mentioned it also. Do you explain to them that this is, you know, this doesn't have to be perfect, number one, and a follow-through on that is, do you believe in people doing more than one four-step or on certain things, or how do you approach that?
I do, because this first fourth step, I mean, the tenth step is good for day-to-day and ongoing stuff, but if there's a big issue, then another fourth step may be in order. And the fact is, you know, early on, there's only so much I can see, and there's only so much I can understand and process, and I think there's only so much God will let me see, because it'll make me nuts. And so that's, you know, and so at the beginning, it gets the heavy stuff that's really going to trip me up right away, or, you know, just the real bad stuff. It's really about willingness and making an effort and making a start to be as thorough as I can at that moment. And if I find out later I miss something, then I'll just deal with it, you know, but it's really, it says like grosser chunks, and I took that to mean big, bad, immediate, obvious stuff that would get me drunk fast. Thank you.
Thank you.